This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about community as a factor in mental health with Kenneth Nixon, a community organizer, proud dad, and religious pastor. And yes, before anyone emails me, I'm aware that when I say it, in my voice, it sounds like he's a spaghetti really into God. I went to a majority Black African church when I was younger, and that is how our religious leader said it. I'm aware that on paper, it has an O in it. Anyway, we're getting sidetracked. This guest is an absolute delight, and we connected right away. There was so much of his story that I so appreciated. He had an articulation to him, which you can imagine, as someone really into words, I just buzzed off. And unsurprisingly, he was telling me that not only has he got this new book called Born Into Crisis coming out, which releases on May 2nd, he also has been signed up to write 4 books in total, which I know enough about publishing to know pretty unusual in general, but particularly these days with the price of printing. So, such a wonderful guest. We also got into some of the systematic problems within the mental health system, both in the US and also around the world. There's a lot of changes that are very much parallel that I'm glad we got to speak on. We also talked about some of the crossovers with the criminal justice system and just so many intersections into how, like this show is here to explore, mental health influences and is influenced by just about everything. So one big conversation, a lot covered, and go get the book, 2nd of May. You can go pre-order it now. It's called Born Into Crisis. The only other thing I'm going to say, so I'm recording this the day after the episode was recorded. I was pretty exhausted, and I don't say this to be an excuse because it's a great episode. In my extroverted self, it only took a few minutes of me talking to such a cool and interesting human for me to perk right up. But I just want to address it in the interest of being honest about mental health, right? That I'm in a particularly busy time at the moment. I've taken on a lot of additional work and my schedule is a bit switched around. And so I'm adjusting to that. I'm doing the boring but important self-care of self-parenting, really, of setting a bedtime for myself, trying to get into a really solid routine, making sure I eat first thing in the morning, even though I don't tend to be hungry when I wake up. But, you know, I need to set myself up because I've got a lot on for the day. And so, yeah, I wanted to share that partly because mental health is such an ongoing thing. And I never want to be in the position of I've got all the answers and I've got it all figured out, because sometimes I really have these reminders of, okay, this week we need to get back to basics, because how exhausted I was yesterday recording this, it's not sustainable. And so sometimes you got to be a serious adult person and put yourself in check and be like, okay, we're going to look after ourselves a bit better, because you've got too much on for you to burn yourself out. Yeah, basically. Does that sound toxic that I'm doing self-care just to get my work done? I don't mean that. I'm just having to think about it more at the moment because I've got so much work. That's how I'm selling it. Yep. For now, though, let's get into the episode with Kenneth Nixon in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Kenneth Nixon of the state of Virginia in the United States. And my story starts at the very beginning at birth. My father, getting off of work, was concerned about my mother being left alone, especially when it was getting close to the time for my birth. And when he arrived at the apartment, he saw that I was actually lying on the floor wrapped in newspaper, and there was blood pooling near me. My mother was in the throes of a psychosis, a mental health episode at the moment, and she was sitting off in the corner. And part of why I always tell people that I was born in a crisis, right, it's not just that moment, but I was also shaking, crying a lot. And when I finally got to the hospital, and they ran a series of tests, did blood work, they identified I was suffering from withdrawals from antipsychotic medication called Thorazine, which was historically used to treat various different mental health illnesses at the time. So as a newborn, I was having withdrawals from psych meds. So that's where the story actually starts, literally at birth.
Wow. And it's maybe a sign of how far medicine has come that it's difficult to even imagine, you know, a child being born and it being a knowing thing that a pregnant mother is on that kind of medication. And what was your understanding, obviously not firsthand memory, but what you know of the time of how things were for your parents around the time of your birth? What was it leading up to, you know, trying to prepare for having a child and your mother is in such a difficult place with her mental health?
Yeah, so my mother and father actually met at a house party.
Okay.
At the time, and the way the story is told, obviously I was not there, but the story that was told to me by my father was that they were a couple of single people at a party who were having drinks, and one thing led to another, an inebriated night led to them having a child, but they never were in a kind of an exclusive or dedicated relationship or partnership. And my father only came to know that my mother was pregnant with me because of my grandmother, knew my mother Ramona well and would look after her sometimes because of her mental health condition, because they lived in the same apartment building back then in the 80s. And so it was never a relationship per se, but it was more of he knew that he was having a child on the way, so he always wanted to keep a close contact and connection to make sure that he was a resource, because my father had custody of me since I was a week old. And that's when the courts turned custody over to him. And there's even a story behind that. But my parents never had a relationship. And it's kind of dancing around that whole concept of a one-night stand. Mm-hmm. But that's essentially what it kind of boils down to.
Interesting. And it's refreshing to hear that they've been so open with you about that. Also interesting how your dad got custody there, because again, like, you know, when we look back to the time of your birth, that was even more unusual than that the man in an opposite gender couple would be the one that ends up with custody. But I guess a reflection go ahead.
Oh, no. It was one of those things where my grandmother stayed on top of him as well.
Okay.
My dad's mother. So he did have kind of a little bit of pressure there. But the circumstances that led to kind of that custody move quickly, within a couple of days of being released from the hospital into my mother's care, which years later, looking back, points to some of the systemic issues. Because someone who has a documented medical history of mental health challenges that's well-founded, releasing a child into their care looking back at it years later, was kind of baffling to me, to some of the systematic failures, because within 3 or 4 days, she returned to the hospital with me saying that I was not breathing. But the medical professional, there was nothing wrong with me. I was breathing fine. I was normal. But someone who has that type of limitation in terms of mental health should not have been left to their own devices. Led to me thinking, oh my goodness, how was I fed? Like years later, not as a child, but how was I fed? Who changed my diapers? Like, how did this happen? But that was the first time. The second time she returned with me to say I wasn't breathing, that's when the hospital decided that they would not release me to her. And my father came, and that's when he filed an emergency petition with the, we call it the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, to get an emergency custody order, which he was granted based off of my mother's documented mental health history. But just imagine, I'm here, grateful, thank God that I'm here, but just imagine someone who does not have the capacity to understand or care for themselves. The worst could have happened, being released into her care. And she could have meant no harm by any of her behavior or actions, but in her mind was doing the best that she could do. But it could have led to tragic outcomes where I'm not here today, because the system did not appropriately create a continuum of care around that. But thankfully, I was able to be placed with my father.
For sure. And as you started to grow up and, you know, then have memories about your childhood experiences, what was your understanding like of how you ended up in your dad's care and, you know, what your mother was dealing with mental health-wise?
So it was a very difficult childhood. I had, like, my father and my grandmother, there were certain stabilizing elements about my childhood. But that's balanced against the chaos and everything, which led to me developing PTSD, having anxiety, and some of the challenges that I still deal with openly today, considering that when I was a child, my mother would just kick in the door of where I was staying with my father and start screaming and yelling at him. And I'm 5, 6 years old, not knowing how to process what's going on. And then she would disappear. I wouldn't see her for 6 months. Or I would be at school and school would go on lockdown. And I don't know what's going on. I'm in kindergarten or first grade, and they're putting me into a supply closet because they're putting the school on lockdown. Being at the recreation center around the corner, like a 5 or 6 year old.
And so, with that, it was that she was trying to take you from the school? Is that what was happening there?
That's what they would think, but I think there's depth there, right? There's more nuance. And I kind of detail that in a lot of the writings that I do, that my innate sense is that she wanted to just see me. It was her reaction, her way of trying to express the hurt that she potentially felt that she did not have her son in her life, or she did not have consistent access. Now, as a child, it's very traumatic, but as an adult, you can see how someone who does not have the coping skills or the ability to regulate their emotions could act out or react in such manners. But it's really expressing hurt, it's expressing fear, it's expressing a need to be close to something. And that goes into the whole conversation about destigmatization of mental illness and really understanding what, at the core, what is that person trying to express emotion?
No, I think that's such an important and nuanced part of this, is finding the lines between understanding the context of what somebody's going through, you know, understanding that this is somebody that's, yes, like you said, struggling to maintain their emotions, combined with the desperation of, you know, that connection she's lacking from her child and feeling, you know, maybe out of control of herself, but also out of control of that situation. And so there's an important distinction there between considering what's best for her and what's best for you, but then not going so far into it that she's demonized in any way, that she's treated as dangerous because of the personal crisis that she's going through, but instead finding safeguards to protect both of you.
Yeah. It's one of those things, as people begin to understand and connect to this issue, one of the things I try to help people understand that if you're given the blessing of this thing we call life, everyone who breathes experiences a mental health issue in different ways and in different extremes. Everybody deals with anxiety at some point. Everyone deals with stress, uncertainty, insecurities. It just manifests differently in people on different scales or spectrums. And it's really helping people to understand that mental health is just health.
Mm-hmm.
There's physical and then there's mental, but it all goes into the same bucket of health. And we all experience it. And if someone ever says to me, and I've had people say that, well, I've never personally have dealt with it. I always say that's interesting. Have you ever been stressed? Have you ever been anxious about something or anger, upset? We all experience it. It just manifests in different waves, in different modes that some people get to the point where they need that extra level of care and treatment to support them through it.
Yes, that is so brilliantly said. I'm very much of the same thinking. And it's a difficult thing to describe sometimes because that isn't to take away from how serious diagnosable mental illness is when we can also acknowledge that, yes, there are symptoms that we might all experience. You know, maybe not all of us. It's to the level or the kind of frequency or whatever criteria for a diagnosis. But there's a reason why the more you learn about mental ill health, the more you can relate to it, you know, and even 300 episodes into this show, there's still new conditions we cover that I might be surprised how much I relate to. And that's not because it's a diagnosis that I didn't know about that I had. It's that so much of this is part of the universal human experience, even if, as you say, we experience this in different shades. And as you started to grow up and, you know, were grappling with understanding the situation your mother was in, how did your awareness develop in terms of your own mental health?
Well, the thread line wasn't exactly as clear for me until my father passed away in 2019 from cancer. And I say that because he was the, as I mentioned earlier, about having a stabilizing force in the midst of everything that was going on. My paradigm shifted because the one person I always had in my life is no longer here. So it was disorienting and it unlocked to an increased level the anxiety, the PTSD, the depression, some of the things that I felt my whole childhood into adulthood, and I quickly recognized them, but they were a lot more intense. And then I had to realize I need to see someone because I think I've had undiagnosed illnesses that I have not grappled with. And it was in talking to a therapist, and growing up, I was always like, oh, I'm tough, I had to cry, you know, it's like, suck it up, keep it moving, I'm good to go. Guys, don't cry. Crying is not only good for the soul, but it's a necessary mechanism to help with coping and to release stress and anxiety. And it is okay not to be okay. And through that process of grieving my father, I unlocked this softer side of me that was always there, but I was always taught based off of environment or based off of just learned patterns from being raised by my father, that you can affect in a negative way your health if you're not willing to allow your body to use natural ways of releasing stress and anxiety, which crying is one of them. And I really have learned how to use and allow my body to naturally release those things when I'm going through things. And going against societal norms, which kind of look at men awkwardly when they're crying and doing those things and really embracing it as a way of treating my soul.
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't agree more. I I'm such a believer in crying, and I wish I could do it more. I've had that similar journey where I grew up and I was like, no, I'm tough. And that is a big part of how I survive certain things, like going a long time before realizing mental illness was the answer to some of the struggles that I was going through. You know, in a way that did get me through, but, you know, in a temporary way. You know, and now I'm increasingly, through also therapy and other tools, yeah, still working on getting to that point where it's like, okay, I'm grateful to that me. I'm grateful for the kind of the exterior shell I was able to build up and the toughness that I took on the world. But, you know, the lovely thing is, as you learn to soften as a man, you see all the ways in which you're actually more relatable, easier for people to connect to. You know, people open up to you more, you feel more comfortable doing the same. Yet it's a long journey, you know, so I still have that where I would like to be able to cry easier. And, you know, I don't know how much of that is this kind of stuff that I've built up over the years. And what you've mentioned there, I think, is a great way of linking to today's theme of community, because that's also something we can so benefit from, of being more open with our emotions. And could you share a little bit of your experience connecting with others through your work?
Mm-hmm. So that's actually a great segue right there, because I'm a firm believer now that there is community somewhere for everyone. It's a matter of finding it and the resources that will connect you to that community. So the work I do is grounded in this foundational but pretty routine concept found throughout history of community organizing. You can find it in any great nonviolent movements for rights, human rights, social justice, or civil rights. You can look at community organizing from apartheid in South Africa to civil rights, desegregation struggle in the United States, to freedoms throughout the world. And it's this concept that ordinary folks who deeply connected personally to an issue that's at their core interest feel compelled to share their story, but also find other people who have similar stories and come together to create relational power and come together under the guise of a concept called collective power, which is organized and organized money. Right, to get any type of power or systemic change on any type of rights or justice issue, it requires a collective power. And there's two components to it, organized people and organized money. But the organized people are not lobbyists or special interest groups that are descending to create change. It is ordinary people who've decided to come together and create the power necessary to create systemic change, because we recognize that absence of that community, we as an individual cannot move systems. Like Kenneth Nixon cannot move the mental health system in the United States by himself. I can't move it in my local community by myself. But creating a community of affected people who are directly or indirectly impacted to come together to create that collective power is where I found community to begin to change and shift systems.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because we can so often see problems as part of a sort of amorphous political blob, when in reality, it's all people behind it. Mm-hmm. You know, campaigning is as much about networking as it is protesting or writing letters or, you know, anything else, petitions that we might think of. So I really appreciate that. And for you on a personal level, what's it been like? I know you talk about it in the book a lot, finding people with parallel stories to yourself and being surprised that there's so many people out there that you can relate to more than you would have known.
Yeah. On a personal level, what I've realized is that no matter how bad you think your circumstances were or are, there's always someone who has different circumstances but similar thread lines to your story. And there's always someone whose story causes your heart to drop because the circumstances surrounding it makes your story, while still significant and important, fit into a greater context of I'm not alone, right? And understanding that there is a community that is looking to connect with each other. You just have to find it and create the space where you can come together collectively and feed off of that to actually get some good things done. And that's the statement I personally have taken to heart. It sounds cliche, but when you actually are in the midst of listening to people's stories and you're connecting to the human condition, to the heart, not their particular circumstance, but the feelings of hurt and anxiety that you can relate to, mm-hmm. the feeling of isolation or the things that you had to grapple with and try to navigate, you quickly realize that I am not alone takes on such an innate concept, and that you create this instant connection with someone you otherwise would take time to get to know, to build a relationship. The thing about trauma, well, you can say that about love or anything else, but the thing about those type of feelings and emotion, trauma can connect people through storytelling and create a sense of community to help people be able to feel comfortable sharing and to begin to do things that they always had the power and strength to do, but they needed to find that community before they stepped into that power.
Yes. Oh, I so agree. I'm sure you get this all the time, but you were born to be like a religious leader. Like I was not surprised at all when I found out that that was your work, a lot of your background, given how you speak, you know, the gravitas, the eloquence. But I so agree with you there. That's ended up being a big core of my work, is that so much of destigmatizing, I think, is about demystifying mental illness, that it has for so long been treated as this other thing that happens to other people. And if it's not other people, you better keep it quiet. You better keep up the illusion that it's a thing over there that we don't touch and we don't talk about. And the reality is, it's very relatable. And these conversations, I'm constantly surprised that I'm relatable at all, because I just didn't know that. And more surprising still, that it's so often the vulnerable things that we're encouraged to hide, to push down, to not speak up about, are often the things that people can connect with us easiest on, if we can create safe spaces for these conversations. And I can see why that's been such a tool for you in understanding your own experiences and connecting to others. What are some other things that have helped in your recovery?
So some of the other things that have helped, I don't use the term recovery. Mm-hmm. Me personally, I don't use the term recovery, because when you go through things traumatic, they're always a part of you. What I like to use is the term of empowerment, because you can get to the point of transition where you have done the work to get to a place where your pain and hurt becomes a catalyst, like your podcast and other things that you're doing, to help other people to begin coming out of the throes of whatever they're going through. And nothing happens on accident. Everything, in my belief, happens for a purpose. And we go through things for a reason. Classic example, I tell people when they say, oh, with time, the passing of my father, with time, you'll eventually get over it. You will be well. And I say, no, I'm never going to be good. I'm never going to be well. What I will be is better able to cope with the emotions and deal with it in a healthy way that allows me to support other people going through the same process. But it's always going to be a part of who I am. It's always going to be a part of my being, but I'm able to use it as a way to help others. But there are going to be moments where I still feel it intensely, like anyone else. The difference is I've done the work to be able to deal with it, to process it, to get to a place where it doesn't consume.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And I think you know, there are many experiences we go through in life. Losing a parent is one of them, where unless you've been through it, I don't think you can begin to wrap your head around, you know, what kind of grief that is. And I so appreciate what you shared there about empowerment versus recovery, because so often the tools that we, you know, describe within the concept of recovery are things that, yes, empower you to cope better, empower you to live in a way that's kind of more in your autonomy and that you're happier in, you know, give you tools should you get bad again. You can cope with it differently this time. So I'm gonna be taking that home with me. I'm gonna be thinking on that more.
No problem.
And as we start to wrap up then, could you share a little bit about, you know, when you look back on how things started for you, the beginning of this conversation, what's it been like to unpick so much of that in therapy, you know, to figure out what elements of it contributed to the PTSD and find a way to, is it a case of making peace with certain things you went through?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was one of the most eye-opening experiences for me was really the advocacy work that I started doing as an adult and that I've been doing for years, to really understand how much the systemic component of this feeds and somewhat fuels some of the generational cycles and some of the things that people go through. And it's not all on dysfunctional family dynamics and the internal trappings of, oh, my family is just terrible. We can't function. We don't know how to relate to each other. But taking that step back to say, yes, that may be a part of it. And let's look at everything that surrounds that, a system in which my mother, between 1989 and 1993, was arrested and charged 37 times. We're talking disorderly conduct, drunk in public, disturbing the peace, substance abuse issues, and she had a documented mental health history. But the system kept doing this vicious cycle of local incarceration, state psychiatric hospitals, and the whole concept was stabilized release. Wasn't treatment, stabilization and release. And it created this vicious cycle, right? Because she was not in a system, a continuum of care to help her have permanent supportive housing, where you have a live-in therapist in that community and the resources to make sure she's taking her medications and going to counseling and living a productive life, you had this vicious cycle of heavy law enforcement interaction and stabilize and release. But what was she released to? Back into a community where I'm 5, 6, 7 years old. I don't have the wherewithal to know or deal or cope with my mother in the community. So she would come back in, not meaning any harm, but she's in the throes of psychosis and trying to interact with her son. So that's creating mental health problems for me now that the system has to treat, because it's not putting the things in place to end generational cycles. So personally for me, I discovered that it's so much more than just your internal family dynamics or genetics. Genetics is tied to the environment when you talk about generational cycles. And what helps those environments is the systems that support the environments that can break those generational cycles of chaos, of dysfunction. But we have to be willing to do the work to change those systems.
Yes, 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 yes. It's something that is so often treated as a hypothetical. The idea of this conversation around inherited trauma and generational trauma. And you've so clearly outlined how not only are there so many through lines we can find in our own families, but it's also within the context of the systems we're dealing with, like, you know, the mental health system, like how policing is done and all the changes that are required there. And so, you know, not only is it not a, yeah, my family's, you know, in a kind of dismissive way, my family's fucked up or we can't get our shit together. Mm-hmm. There's something very concrete to this, but also that is backed up. You know, if the mental health system doesn't get better, then even if certain things in the family do, when you need support, the support is not going to be better. And so the cycle is influenced by the external as well. So beautifully shared. And the other thing I want to highlight there, because it should go without saying, but it's still something that a lot of people, I think if they haven't had some of this firsthand experience, don't find the easiest to get. And that's around the intervention of law enforcement there. You know, like you described it, the heavy-handed nature of how many arrests and many of the ways in which people of colour are treated still today, you know, in the States. But, you know, it's not a US-specific problem. And it's something that's very much kind of shifting in terms of, you know, the way we look at inequality here in Ireland and the way in which these conversations are had. So one that's a big one, you know, within our health service at the moment is re-examining language around quote-unquote difficult to reach groups. Mm-hmm. Because that's been the accepted language for so long, that people from minority backgrounds in Ireland are often considered difficult to reach groups within a mental health services context. Mm-hmm. And yet, increasingly, people are realizing, is it more accurate and more helpful to look at this as underserved communities? People that mm-hmm. have not only not been provided in resourcing, but also examples like you give, there's plenty of parallels of that here, where if your experiences of services is so often via heavy-handed policing, when your mum's mm-hmm. going through a difficult period, is she going to be eager to go seek services based on those experiences?
Mm-hmm. So you bring up a great point. The challenge, right, when you're on different spectrums of the mental health paradigm, my mother, for instance, does not have the capacity to determine when she needs to seek services. And that's where a system should already have her in a supportive environment so it doesn't keep her in a loop or a cycle. But others don't, there are resources, but they don't know how to access them. They're not well communicated into community. And to your point, I'm speaking specifically on my experience in the state. I've heard the concept of underserved communities or hard to reach communities. And I hear crickets when I respond because people haven't wrestled with what I'm about to say. I usually say that's interesting because those communities that you say that are hard to reach, law enforcement seems to find them pretty easily.
Yes.
So
that is a great way of putting it.
Help me understand how we're having difficulty reaching these communities to bring awareness of resources.
Yes, it's such a good point. And I so appreciate the work you're doing, you know, highlighting these issues, highlighting how much needs to change. And it's been a privilege to talk to you today.
Thank you as well. And keep up the great work that you're doing. There's power in stories and you having a platform that allows people to share their stories is changing lives. And I hope you realize that.
Thank you. Yes. It's really the proudest thing in my life. And if people want to find something that I'm sure you're very proud of, I'm proud of for you, this new book of yours. Tell us about that.
Born into Crisis is a memoir, and it ties into the work that I'm doing. And I consider it like one big relational part of community organizing, where it's in two parts, my personal story and then a call to action is part two. But in the first part, I detail my personal story as a way of, and I write in a conversational tone as if I'm sitting down talking to you. And the whole concept is to help you understand the fire in my belly, what is at my core interest and why I'm so passionate about this issue. But it also is a way to allow people who read it, who can connect to it, to also walk away with some concrete, tangible steps that they can take to begin to shift the paradigm of the dynamic in their life and in their community around relational organizing and finding and connecting with people with similar stories to create collective power to change systems. And I conclude in my book with not only telling people to fight back, but also that none of us control our beginning, but we damn sure have a say in its conclusion.
100%. And on that note, we will wrap up there. Thank you again.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
You don't need to be ripped. You just need the right shirt. Epic Fits gives you a clean, confident silhouette. Snug on the arms, soft on the skin, generous where it counts. And with deals like $15 per tee, they won't break the bank. Visit epicfits.com today. Epic Fits. T-shirts that get it.